Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to FedSoc Forums. My name is Libby Dickinson, and I'm an Associate Director with the Federal Society's Practice Groups. As a reminder, all opinions expressed are those of our speakers and not of the Federalist Society. Today's program is one of my personal favorite titles, Race to a Moon Base and Frontiers Beyond. Today's moderator is Margaret Harker, litigator and former attorney with the Department of Justice. If our audience has any questions throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through Zoom's Q&A feature located at the bottom of your screen and not the chat, so that we'll be able to access them later. With that note, I will turn things over to our speakers to start the conversation. Margaret, thank you so much for joining us today and for moderating today's discussion.
Thank you, Libby, and good afternoon. We're looking forward to hearing our panel today with varied backgrounds and perspectives discussing Race to Moon Base and Frontiers Beyond. Our panelists will discuss a number of topics, the next frontiers in space, the Artemis Moon to Mars campaign, including the recent awesome Artemis II mission to the far side of the moon, the space race with China, the proper role of commercial space, and risks commercial partnerships could pose for Americans. We don't want to inspire greatness, achieve greatness, only to have the CCP steal it all. Panelists will also address the necessary legal framework to achieve America's goals as territorial and other disputes arise in space. The role of dual-use technologies, nuclear spaceships, satellites, and more. During the first space race, President Kennedy remarked in 1962, "We set sail on this new sea because there is new knowledge to be gained and new rights to be won, and they must be won and used for progress of all people. Whether it will be a force for good or ill depends on man. And only if the United States occupies a position of preeminence can we help decide whether this new ocean will be a sea of peace or a new terrifying theater of war." President Kennedy's remarks are equally applicable today as we are in a new space race. NASA is led by Administrator Jarek Isaacman, who has welcomed commercial partnerships while making strong statements about the imperative of America beating China in this race. Before becoming administrator, he told Sean Ryan on his podcast that he has been really, really concerned about China's progress while America at the time was stagnant. The administrator added that it would be a major blow if China gets there first after we've said for 35 years that we're going back. It would affect American exceptionalism. He noted that he will be fired if a Chinese taikonaut walks on the moon before an American. He also said, "Russia isn't really a player anymore. Sure, from the Department of Defense's perspective, but China is the one that will cause issues in civil and military space. He believes, thanks to SpaceX, China is not beating us at the moment." I am very excited to hear our panelists' thoughts on all of this. Thank you to each of our speakers for participating. Each speaker will give opening remarks for 10 minutes, and we'll have time for Q&A at the end. If you have questions, please put them in the chat box. Go to the Federal Society website for the full biography of each panelist, but I'll give brief introductions. Our first panelist is Dean Chung. Dean is a non-resident senior fellow at Potomac Institute for Policy Studies at GW's Space Policy Institute. Previously, he was a senior advisor to the China program at the Institute of Peace after retiring as senior research fellow for Chinese political and security affairs at Heritage Foundation. He is the author of Cyber Dragon, Inside China's Information Warfare and Cyber Operations, and China and the New Moon Race. Our second panelist is Rick Fisher. Rick has been following China's space program since attending the first air show China, Zhuhai Air Show, in 1996. A senior fellow with the International Assessment and Strategy Center, he has previously worked for the Center for Security Policy, the Jamestown Foundation, the House Republican Policy Committee, and the Heritage Foundation. Our third panelist is Jim Dunstan. Jim has significant experience as a commercial outer space lawyer. He is the founder of Mobius Legal Group and serves as senior counsel at DC-based think tank Tech Freedom. He also teaches outer space law at Scalia Law and Sandra Day O'Connor Law at Arizona State. He has testified before Congress on issues of space law and policy. Dean, please kick it off.
Thank you. Margaret, thank you to the Federalist Society for the opportunity to be here today. I was asked to set the stage by talking a little bit about who are the Chinese as a space competitor, because as now NASA director, NASA Administrator Isaacman said, China really is our primary competitor. So it's important to understand to begin with that the Chinese space program is very different from either ours or the Soviet / Russian space program. The American and Soviet space programs began out of a desire for strategic intelligence. John Logsdon, a longtime observer of the space community, said that the American space program arguably began on December 8th, 1941. If only we had seen the Japanese fleet approaching, we could have avoided Pearl Harbor. And if John is correct, then arguably, the Soviet space program began on June 23rd, 1941, if only they had seen the 3 million troops the Nazis were assembling to invade the Soviet Union, they could have avoided their strategic catastrophes in the opening days. China has never had a strategic catastrophe like that. Their space program, therefore, did not begin with the desire for missile early warning and reconnaissance. Their first satellites were, in fact, commercial satellites. Communication satellites. Driven by the desire for space to help build what the Chinese term comprehensive national power. Comprehensive national power is originally a Japanese term. It basically is how do you measure countries as varied as the United States, Brazil, China, Egypt, Thailand? And the answer is that you have to look at many different things comprehensively. Military power matters. Economic power matters. Political unity matters, diplomatic respect matters, level of science and technology matters, even cultural security matters. And from the Chinese perspective, space touches every single one of those elements. And conversely, every one of those elements can eventually feed into the space program. Diplomatically establishing foreign launch sites, politically building up the political support for the government and for space. The Chinese also see space as vital in the information age. We now live, in their view, in the information age, where the currency of power has shifted from how many I-beams did you produce last year? How many merchant ships did you produce last year? To how much information do you generate? How quickly can you move it? How quickly can you exploit it? And space is a key means of finding out things, communicating things, exploiting that information that you've accumulated. So for the PRC, because we live in the information age, developing their space program is essential. And so the Chinese have a plan. They intend to build up their space industrial base, including the commercial sector. So China has been working very hard since 2014, 2015 to develop not only their state-owned enterprise-based space industrial complex, which has always been a key component, but now actual commercial companies that compete based on price, based on technological innovation. They want to build out their space capabilities. That means building out satellite constellations, including ones that are specifically designed to compete with SpaceX and Starlink, build out a cislunar capability, the ability to not only go to the moon, but develop the network of capabilities essential for supporting that, and of course, to build out their military space capacity. And finally, they are building in dual use. China's space program, like every space program, ultimately serves both military and civilian purposes, has both military and commercial / civilian ends. But for the Chinese, they are designing that in. This is not a, oh, hey, here's a new technology. How might I apply it in other ways? They are saying every renminbi, every yuan that we spend on space has to do double, triple, quadruple duty, building up the military, building up the broader industrial base, building up comprehensive national power. So when we look at the moon, what we see is a Chinese space program, Chinese lunar program that is sustained systematic, and strategic. By sustained, what we mean is that it is not constantly changing its goals. There's programmatic stability. As NASA Administrator Isaacman has pointed out, and others before him, we have had many, many plans to go to the, back to the moon. We've had many, many plans to go to Mars. In fact, I suspect that if you stacked all of those plans one on top of the other, we could have walked at least to the moon by now. And then every next administration changes and jettisons. And so here we are in 2026, racing with China for us to go back to a place that we went to almost 70 years ago. The Chinese effort is systematic. This is not a lunge. This is a marathon for them. There's various programs. Human spaceflight, lunar spaceflight has been consistently crawl, walk, run. With the lunar effort, it was an orbiter, then a lander, and then a sample retrieval mission. And we should expect to see that kind of systematic paced development for their lunar efforts. And finally, it's strategic. This is not just a will-o'-the-wisp for Xi Jinping. This is a long-standing effort. It is one that feeds into the so-called China dream, the great revival of the Chinese people. And in fact, it is specifically said that the Chinese lunar program is part of the Chinese space dream. When we look at the specifics, what we see is an effort to develop the components, as I said earlier, crawl, walk, run. We've seen the landers, we've seen the orbiters, we've seen them land on the far side of the moon, something no one has done before, and even bring samples back. Now we see the International Lunar Research Station. That's the broader title for their Chinese moon base effort. This is undertaken in conjunction with the Russians and about 11 other partners at the moment, far fewer than Artemis. But at the same time, a distinct set of goals for all the participating countries. So Russia, for example, is going to be building, at least in their current official plans, a nuclear power plant to be built on the moon. What we expect to see is a manned lunar mission by 2030. This would be very complex, involving multiple launches and multiple dockings. And the Chinese are, in fact, currently testing the Long March 10 booster. They have tested the Lunria lunar lander. So all of these various parts, they will come together by 2030. Notably for us, the United States, I believe we just announced the deferral, if not cancellation, of Artemis 3. And we're not really sure at this point then what is supposed to follow Artemis 2's success. One of the things I really do want to emphasize here as we close is that for the Chinese, it is not simply about landing on the moon. It is about establishing the rules for space governance. So one of the things that they are already laying the groundwork for is the deployment of a lunar PNT system. PNT is position, navigation, timing. Terrestrial versions are GPS, GLONASS, the Chinese Beidou, the European Galileo system. The point here is that the Chinese, even before they put boots on the lunar soil, are going to be deploying a PNT network. And this is essential. This is vital because that network will first tell anyone who subscribes to it, where are you? The same way GPS does. But one, it will integrate communications. And by the way, the Beidou system, the Chinese version of GPS, has a communications background. But more to the point, once they deploy it, especially if they are first, then other nations and commercial providers, including Western commercial providers, are very likely to use the Chinese network because, one, it will be free. And two, it will be in place. And three, it is far more expensive to try and deploy your own PNT network than to use someone else's. And once the Chinese have established this PNT network, especially if they get other people, other nations, other companies to use it, then what they have established is that Chinese will be the language of space travel. Chinese is potentially the language of lunar space traffic management, and China will establish a data format and data standards. And that is the key to governance. You can't establish sovereignty over the moon, but you can absolutely establish communications networks and establish standards and establish the baselines for how are people supposed to interact. And that is a key part of the power associated with the Chinese lunar effort. Thank you very much again for the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you, Dean. Rick?
I would also like to thank the Federalist Society for the invitation, and specifically Margaret Harker for asking me to join the panel today. To Dean Chung's excellent opening tour of the Chinese space program motivations and what they're doing, I'd like to focus more intently on the motivations of the Chinese Communist Party, the race to the moon, and what I contend is the more important race for the moon, and how China is also extending this race into our solar system. To Dean's excellent intro comments, I would add that China's space program has also been very closely associated with the prestige and power requirements of the Chinese Communist Party. Mao Zedong in the early to mid 1950s began China's rocket program, assembling experts from across China and even from the United States, combining that with what information and technology he could obtain from the Soviet Union at the time, and began to assemble larger and larger rockets, eventually intercontinental ballistic missile size rockets. But even in the early 1960s, the chaos of the post-revolutionary period and in the beginning of the Cultural Revolution, when China was, you know, awash in violence and in chaos, Mao began a missile defense program. It lasted until Deng Xiaoping cut off the funding in about 1980. But Mao also began, but didn't complete, an attempt to build a manned space program in the late 1960s. They actually had a plan to exploit an ICBM and to put one astronaut or taikonaut into orbit. Again, the money wasn't there. It moved along until the early 1990s, when again China reached out to the former Soviet Union, imported a lot of technology, and then modified that technology and took off from there. But for China, for the Chinese Communist Party, space is extremely important, not only from the points that Dean mentioned, but also as a means to keep up with the West, keep up with the competition, keep up with the United States, and to eventually surpass the United States. If the Chinese Communist Party's goal is to become the preeminent power on Earth, the new hegemon, it regards space as an insurance policy for achieving that level of power. In a raw power way, if the Americans can still go to the moon, they can still go to Mars, they can eventually mount a new resistance back on Earth. So do they want to prevent us from reaching the moon and beyond? Not specifically, but they definitely want to be able to deny that, control that, if they can. And the pieces that I see coming together definitely would lead one to that conclusion. Now, the race to the moon. As Dean pointed out, China's program benefits from consistency and also from relative simplicity. The Chinese are essentially, in terms of mass and weight, simply trying to replicate the Apollo program of the 1960s. The combined manned spacecraft and lunar lander is essentially 48 tons. The Apollo manned spaceship and lunar excursion module lander added up to about 43 tons. The Chinese are dividing that payload between two Long March 10 space launch vehicles, the Mengzhou and then the Lanyue moon lander will dock in lunar orbit. And then the Lanyue will take two astronauts down to the surface of the moon. But there's a very important aspect here. The Lanyue lander has two stages. One is the lander where the astronauts will reside, but a separate propulsion stage will achieve most of the descent speed, bringing the lander closer to the lunar surface. Just before the lander actually lands on the moon, the propulsion stage breaks off and crashes into the moon. That could be a problem as things develop. But at this point, it looks as if China can make its goal of landing its people on the moon by 2030. I think they could do it earlier, possibly by 2029, if the pieces come together as the Chinese plan. The United States wants to achieve two landings on the moon by 2028. But as we all see, budgets, politics, technology, they're all difficult, and plans are often not met, especially in our system. And of course, the Chinese have a vote here. They could start wars. They could start a war on the Taiwan Strait. If that war spreads to Japan and the Philippines, then they will definitely be affecting the timeline of the American moon program. Now, the race for the moon, as I mentioned earlier, I think is just as important, maybe more important than the actual race to the moon. President Trump would not agree. He wants to get there first. He wants to get there in 2028. I hope it works. I hope Administrator Isaacman is able to deliver that prize. But what's more important is what follows. And on March 24th, during the NASA ignition briefings, a very detailed plan for occupying the moon, setting up an American presence, a permanent presence, was very well explained. By 2036, we should have maybe 79 rockets launched to the moon, 20 manned moon landings by 2036, 4 habitats, 9 rovers, 49 unmanned moon landing systems. Both China and the United States are in the process of deploying lunar satellite systems. I think as Dean mentioned, we plan 10 satellites by 2028. China could be planning 20 to 30 lunar satellites, moon hoppers. The Americans plan 8. The Chinese are sending the first moon hopper later this year. The Americans, perhaps 7 to 8 nuclear power plants on the moon. China, Russia, we don't know how many. And as was explained in the ignition briefings, both the Americans are aiming first to populate the South Pole of the moon, as are the Chinese. And as was explained on March 24, we're aiming for a size, an area on the South Pole of the moon, about the size of the state of Virginia. Now, I live in Virginia. It's a fairly large state, but I think that anyone would be a little concerned if errant propulsion stages are crashing around me. Given the Chinese penchant for being rather cavalier with the degree to which first stages have been crashing in China after launch and crashing on villages, causing casualties. These are incidents that are not very well reported, but information has emerged over the decades. This is a problem. Could this be deconflicted? Yeah, you could sit down for coffee or tea at the International Astronautical Congress, a big space convention that happens every year, and work out a simple deconfliction plan. I'm going here. I'm landing this direction. Try not to put your moon habitat on the other side or nearby. That's simple to do and can be done in a way that is compliant with the restrictions that Congress placed on dialogue with China about 16, 17 years ago. We could work that out. But China is reluctant to talk or even engage in limitation of nuclear weapons on Earth. It's difficult to see how they would enter into discussions for deconfliction on the moon. But of course, we should try. Now, I also mentioned China has larger goals. Indeed, the United States, President Trump, has voiced his desire to send Americans to Mars. His friendship with Elon Musk is illustrative of that. China also has an active Mars program, and eventually will send people there. But in later 2023, the China Aerospace Science and Technology Corporation, CASC, their premier space technology development company, held a symposium in which they described, according to state media reporting, how they had spent the previous 3 years plotting out a 100-year plan to expand China's presence into the solar system, exploiting Lagrangian points, landing on large asteroids, going to the moons of Jupiter, and then beyond. And this is not just Chinese astronauts and Chinese science. This is also a projection by the Chinese Communist Party. It is also a move to gather prestige, power, and to leverage dual-use technologies for the purpose of power. I mean, if we had a plan to put a small space station around the moon called Gateway that was recently canceled. Chinese space literature, engineering literature, has articles about, China establishing a small station at the Earth-Moon L1 Lagrangian point. This would be between the Earth and the moon, closer to the moon a bit. Now, what is that? Is that a small space station that will assist spacecraft landing on the moon? Or will it be a toll booth? Could go both ways. And this is the kind of competition that I see unfolding. Satellite systems around the moon, definitely be dual use. The degree to which the United States and China are working up combat satellites in low Earth orbit, those could be deployed to defend satellites around the moon. Moon hoppers could behave like any number of unmanned aerial systems on Earth. Nuclear power plants could power future laser mining systems, a laser cannon, if you will, dual use potential there. So our competition with China is real. We are racing to the moon. We are racing for the moon, and we will be racing beyond the moon. And I'll stop there. Thank you again, Margaret.
Thank you, Rick. Jim?
Thanks, Margaret, and thanks to the Federalist Society for inviting me to talk today. I want to take us back to sort of first principles here and talk about what we are talking about. Rick a little bit did this, the difference between a race to the moon versus a race for the moon. How we define that race, I think, is really vital. And is more important to us than it is to, I think, China and how we define it. So if we define it as a race to the moon, I would say we lose. And if we say it's a race to return to the moon, we also lose. Why do I say that? Well, if China gets there first and we define it as a race to the moon, then we lose. But actually, if we get there first, we probably still lose. Why? Well, because we've already done it. It's a been there, done that situation where, we did it 60 years ago. And so if we just repeat Apollo, then in fact, we lose. And it's really important to understand, and Rick pointed this up a little bit about the Chinese architecture. It's really sort of an upgraded Apollo situation in terms of hardware. So they could do an Apollo 11 type landing near the equator, stay for a day or two and come back, and they would get the international prestige. They would then be the second country to do that. Well, if we did that exact same mission, it would actually be a step back. Because if you look at what we did on Apollo 17, we were on the moon for almost 4 days. We did 22 hours of EVA. And so we essentially have to beat ourselves. And the way I want to put this is, and why defining is important, is when Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile in 1954, does anybody know who led the first lap of that race? Well, of course not. It happened to be a guy by the name of Chris Brasher, who was one of his teammates, who was set to set the pace to let him go under four minutes. But the reason we don't know it is because it was a mile race. And so we have to define this as going back to the moon. And I would say that because we have to do better than we did in Apollo, if I can mix my sports analogies, we've got to win the Triple Crown horse race, and we've got to run the Belmont and win by more than 31 lengths. As Secretary did in 1973. And so if you contrast the two, the two architectures, you're seeing that we're doing that. So as Rick said, we're trying to go to the South Pole of the moon. The Apollo landings were all basically near the equator in either the Mare or in highland regions, but they were all fairly flat regions. I like to describe landing the Apollo missions like landing in eastern Colorado. And if anybody knows the topography there, it's still the Great Plains. It's pretty dang flat. Colorado isn't the Colorado you normally see until we hit Denver and move west. Artemis is trying to land essentially on Pikes Peak. And we're doing it actually without any good maps. Don't get me started on how bad the maps of the South Pole are, but they're not really that good. Hence the fact that several of the private landers that have landed have toppled over because they did not understand the topography. And the second thing, we have to stay longer. I've had the honor of sitting with Jack Schmidt from Apollo 17 on a couple of occasions and talked to him about what it was like to be on the moon that long. And he told me very candidly that they were not convinced that they were going to come back from their final EVA with their suits intact, because by the time they put them back on for the third time, they were starting to disintegrate. The joints were starting to go. There was fraying. So the suits that they had for Apollo, we can't take back to the moon. That's actually one of the long poles in the technology tent right now, is our EVA suits aren't good enough to get there. And again, we'll go to the South Pole. Not only is it topographically more challenging to get to, but you also have to do that ugly plane change between the Earth and the Moon. You got to go from a, you know, equatorial orbit to a polar orbit to be able to get there. That's not trivial. If anybody has ever watched any of the, you know, any of the animations of some of the some of these orbits that they're talking about doing, they're pretty darn crazy. So we kind of set ourselves up for a different race than maybe even China is running. And I think we're setting ourselves up for a race that we're not, the public in the United States is not prepared for. And we have to message that very critically, that this is not a race to the moon. This is not a race to return to the moon. This is a race for a moon base. And I would say we will know the winner of that race when the first country has sent the second crew to a habitat that can stay, that can support them for 30 days. At that point, then we do have that boots on the ground. Is it a fair race? Probably not, because again, the stakes are higher for us, but I think we can do it. How can we do it? We've got one thing in better quantities than I think China has, and that is we have innovation and the reward for innovation literally imprinted in our DNA. It goes back to the Declaration of Independence, and it goes back to the Constitution. We've got the patent clause, the Article 1, you know, Section 8, Clause 8. And in fact, when they were debating about the patents clause, Federalist 33, Madison says, the utility of this power will scarcely be questioned. And then Washington, in his first inaugural address, what did he ask Congress for? He asked for a patent act. And in fact, the third act passed by Congress was the 1790 Patent Act. It is ingrained in us that we reward innovation, and we have to keep doing that. I would say the biggest complaint that we can have about what Apollo did was it was a top-down, state-run program. It got us to the moon, it got us there first, but it didn't allow us to stay because there was no reward for innovation. And so that's what we have to look towards. And more generally, we have to look for bringing on our commercial partners, allowing that innovation and allowing them to profit from it. Now, the contracting for Artemis is very different than the contracting for Apollo was. You know, the old cost plus, Congress writes a blank check, and we get to the moon. Artemis has been very, very different. And we had some failures, especially with the Eclipse program, but we had some great successes. And I think that inures to our benefit. And more generally, we have to look towards a regulatory system that encourages entrepreneurship in outer space. And we don't have that right now. We've got a bespoke, crazy patchwork quilt of regulations everywhere from the FCC to the Department of Commerce to FAA that we need to sort of align those together into a lighter touch. And when I talk about regulation, I talk about a continuum. On the far left is permissionless innovation, this ability, this idea that we can just go out and do things and we can break things. And on the far right, you have the precautionary principle, the idea that whatever you do, you can't do any harm. You know, we need to push as close to permissionless innovation as we can to allow people to go break things. Obviously, you have to break things to create orbital debris and stay away from the precautionary principle. And if you're following what's going on in Europe right now with their draft space act, they are way close to the precautionary principle. As long as we can stay out of that mindset and keep us more towards, you know, rewarding innovation, I think we've got a real chance to win both the short race and certainly the long race of getting to the moon. With that, I'll stop.
Thank you. I have some follow-ups, but I want to give our other panelists an opportunity, Dean or Rick, if there's anything you want to respond to from what you heard from the other panelists.
So I'd like to follow up a little bit on Jim's comments. I think that the idea of innovation and the idea that we have to reduce regulation in order to get that innovation is central. The Chinese, up until 2015, were entirely reliant on a state-directed, state-owned enterprise model of space industry. And in 2015, they specifically passed a set of regulations in their internal system that said you know what? We want commercial companies to participate. Why? I would submit that it's three words: Musk, Bezos, Branson. The sad irony is that the CCP that Rick talked about very correctly in his remarks is more open to competition and capitalist innovation than some American universities are. Because the Chinese themselves are saying, you know how we can unleash our keep up with and hopefully surpass the Americans? By letting capitalism in this very narrowly defined sector work. And so when you look at the world, so to speak, of commercial space development, there's no question the United States is the lead. The sad reality is that Europe isn't even also ran. And China is in the middle, edging closer to the United States. It is ironic that when we look for partners to work with, commercially speaking, there are a few in Europe, there's a few in Asia, but not nearly enough to basically fill out the ranks. It's the Chinese who are our primary commercial competitor.
Dean, I'd like to follow up on that briefly, and for you or any of our other panelists, how do we balance the need for commercial partnerships, given essentially that we'll basically be stagnant without them, with the risks of some of engaging with some of the companies that are the players here who have ties to China that, you know, could expose us to theft or much worse, right? You've got Elon Musk's financial stake through Tesla in China. You've got Jeff Bezos, who through Amazon is ingrained with China, even partnering with Chinese propaganda outlets on his website. So how do we ensure that sort of the spirit of the Wolf Amendment is respected while embracing, you know, the need to be innovative? And as Jim said, you know, reward innovation. And that does seem essential to me. So how do we appropriately handle that?
Well, as somebody who has defended the Wolf Amendment in a variety of places, I absolutely agree that we need to recognize the extent of the Chinese threat. We need to make sure, first and foremost, that government, at the end of the day, NASA being the coordinator for our lunar efforts, adheres to both the word and the spirit of the Wolf Amendment. And it saddens me, the number of folks from NASA I've talked to who openly condemn the Wolf Amendment and just wish it would go away, because then we could get so much more done by cooperating with the Chinese. And I think that that mindset is the first problem. With regards to the commercial sector, I think that one of the things that is reflected in that NASA mindset is people, believe it or not, are often still unaware of the extent to which the Chinese are engaged in everything from cyber espionage to strategic competition. That's an education effort. Unfortunately, the same education system that teaches our young people that capitalism is terrible is the same education system that seems to have done a pretty poor job of reminding us of how dangerous the Chinese threat is. I think that the DOJ's former China project, ongoing efforts by the intelligence community and folks like the Federalist Society and other think tanks to get the word out there of how dangerous the Chinese are is essential, so that companies, if they are going to work with the Chinese, do so with open eyes and full understanding. To be fair to Mr. Musk, while he's making a bunch of money off the Chinese, my impression is, particularly for the SpaceX side of things, they understand that the people who are most likely to try and steal their technology are the Chinese. And it probably didn't hurt that the Chinese decided to land a launch vehicle on a pair of chopsticks that look remarkably like the Starship infrastructure.
Yeah. And if I can respond back and Dean, what you said earlier about China putting a PNT system around the moon, my guess is we're going to see a response coming out of the FCC similar to what we're seeing in rip and replace and the other moratoriums on integration of U.S. communication systems into Chinese system. My guess would be there's going to be an order coming out of the FCC in the not too distant future, which essentially says, yeah, they may be putting a PNT system around it. You guys cannot touch. You cannot send any data through that because it immediately compromises us as a country. So my guess is we're not going to see U.S. entities piggybacking on that system.
I would just underscore Dean's comments about the dangers of interacting with China in space. And I was able to attend the 2009 Moscow Air Show. And I asked Energia, the main company, Russian space company, why does the Chinese space station and in its early illustrations look so much like Energia's space station? And I was able to assemble data points from two different sources to the effect that in the late 1990s, the Russians invited about 100 or 200 Chinese interns to reside and learn at Russian space companies. And while the Russians denied selling any kind of plans, space station plans to the Chinese, that's why the Chinese space station looks like the Russian space station module. And so, yes, any contact with the Chinese in any space sphere is going to involve some kind of involuntary transfer of technology. I mean, even if we rescue Chinese astronauts on the surface of the moon, that has to be done with the understanding that as long as the Chinese Communist Party is in charge, they're going to be walking away with information that we may or may not want to have happen. And also, you know, Dean very correctly pointed out the Chinese emphasis on commercial space companies, developing commercial space companies. But I would add that these are commercial companies with Chinese characteristics. They are controlled by the party. They still reside in a system controlled primarily by the People's Liberation Army. They fulfill plans that originate with the People's Liberation Army. But yes, like China has overproduced unmanned companies starting in the early 2000s, at the same time, you know, scores of electric vehicle companies. This same strategy is being applied to space companies. And so, yes, we're looking at possibly 20 to 25 potential SpaceXs coming from China. I mean, and are they going to all succeed? Probably not. But they're going to have markets. They're going to have goals. I primarily think they're all going to be launching warheads for the most part. That's why so many of these space launch vehicle companies are being allowed to grow in China. But indeed, we have to be very clear-eyed as this tidal wave of potential Chinese SpaceXs comes into their own.
Jim spoke about the importance of ensuring that regulation does not hamper progress. All of you in different ways have touched on the problem with the CCP's approach to space exploration contrasted in some way with the American approach. And Jim did speak a bit about maybe the public not being behind what needs to be done to achieve this race for the moon, not just to the moon. So I'm interested in your thoughts on the importance of American values and how we pursue these endeavors, not just rewarding innovation, but inspiring people to engage, to dedicate their lives to make this happen. And what might the downsides be to what I have heard in my own work and investigations from the scientific community, this whole science knows no borders, you know, and I would contrast that with the JFK quote that I read at the beginning. Well, what are we doing this for? It's not just against communist China. What is it for? And I'd be interested in your thoughts on how we can address that problem, who we communicate it to. This really seems fundamentally a cultural issue in one sense.
I'll take a first swing at that. I think that when it comes to American values, there's at least two. There are many ways to think about that, but there's at least two that come to mind. One is literally the power of science. And by science, I mean the skeptical inquiry and the recognition that a single negative case disallows, you know, sort of your fine, wonderful theory, not science, TM. And here, it's interesting to note that if you have a large enough satellite dish in your backyard, and you know what channel to turn to, and it's this public information, you can get pictures that are being transmitted from Hubble or from James Webb Space Telescope or any other Western / American space probe out there. Okay. You can't send it instructions, but you can pick up those pictures because that information is literally freely available. The Chinese, when they have landed on the far side of the moon, when they have done other things, that information, the Chinese are very upfront. This is paid for by the Chinese people. So the Chinese people and Chinese scientists should have first access, first dibs to all of this information. This is not freely shared. Eventually it comes out, although it's an interesting question how much of that sum total that they've obtained comes out. But this is not information that is freely shared. No matter how much scientists believes information wants to be free, Chinese scientists are first and foremost under the thumb of the Chinese Communist Party. The other thing to consider here is something that Ye Pei Jian, the Chinese head of their lunar exploration program at one point said. I won't read the Chinese. The galaxy / universe is an ocean. The moon are the Senkakus or Diaoyutai, and Mars is Scarborough Shoal. He is drawing a direct parallel between pieces of territory in the South China Sea, where China has built artificial islands and then tried to make legal claims that they don't have a right to. And he is drawing a direct comparison to space. So what that says is that the top Chinese leadership is already thinking about space in the confines and constrictions of territorial disputes on Earth, as opposed to the free and open Indo-Pacific, as opposed to the original idea of the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea and elsewhere, that the world's oceans are free for transit and transport, with the very minor exception of territorial waters, which only extend about 12 miles off your shore. So right there is the other issue of values. Do we intend to see space balkanized and controlled from the Chinese perspective, ideally by Beijing, who will indeed say what is and is not available? And evidently Mars is disputed territory already. Or are we going to see space be at least an open area of commerce and transit and transport?
Well, Margaret, to that, I would add that 67 countries now believe that the United States is promoting a value-based projection to the moon that is based on transparency and peaceful conduct. This is the essence of the Artemis Accords. And 67 countries are joining us and finding ways of cooperating with NASA and other partners to realize this vision for a transparent and peaceful future on the moon. And I agree completely with Dean that the Chinese Communist Party does not share this vision. It could very easily peel off in a direction that could cause actual conflict on the moon. And the way in which it deals with its errant moon propulsion, lunar lander propulsion systems, is to me an early test of whether the Chinese Communist Party can alter its values and its supreme selfishness, if you will, and join something approaching an American vision. Of course, they never describe themselves as potentially militaristic or that kind of problem, you know, on the moon or elsewhere, but it's actually happening. And so a kind of dual use system balance of power may be the way in which we go forward and at least try to hold them accountable to a degree that convinces them that a militaristic solution to problems that they see is not necessary or desirable.
Yeah, I want to push back on one thing that, Dean said about the information coming back from the far side of the moon and China. You know, we play that game ourselves. Let's not kid ourselves. We've got 842 pounds of lunar rock sitting in a facility in Houston, which we have declared a United States asset. And in fact, we've doled out less than 10% of that. I wrote an op-ed in Space News, gosh, now 25 years ago, entitled Free the Rocks. And my argument should be that we should just dump all of that stuff out to the scientific community right now, because then that would make us go back. If you do the timeline, we technically don't have to go back to the moon for another 40 or 50 years because we've got plenty of samples still sitting in Houston. So we do play the game of holding on to our cards, you know, as well. But the other thing I want to say, you know, which Dean is really correct in it, is that engineers and scientists fundamentally want to be helpful. You know, they want to further science and they want to further engineering. I tell a lot of people, I spend more time with engineers than I do with lawyers, and I'm fine with that. But they fundamentally think differently than lawyers do, in that they want to solve problems and they want to seek new discoveries. And because of that, they often put on a little bit of set of blinders on who they're talking to and who they're collaborating with. And it's up to us lawyers, I guess, unfortunately, to tell them, maybe you shouldn't be talking to that person at that level.
With 4 minutes to go, I'll read one question from the audience. Is there any chance that U.S. agencies will work together to simplify launch and reentry regulation, perhaps in the manner suggested in the executive order on point in the Office of Space Commerce's March 2026 Space Commerce Certification, which simplifies a denial test and limits decisions to 120 days?
Yeah, I'm the regulatory lawyer on the call. I'll take that first. I wrote a huge paper on this called Gaps, Overlaps, and Stovepipes Regulating Outer Space, talking about this really bespoke system. And unfortunately, we're going to have to get an answer from Congress. Congress is going to have to step in and clean up this mess. I mean, there's an executive order out there where President Trump ordered the Commerce Department to stand up a mission authorization system where to cut down on red tape. The problem with that is Commerce doesn't have the statutory authority to do that. They don't have rulemaking authority. So all they can do is sort of propose it to other agencies. And really, we're going to need Congress to step in and do that. In terms of launch and reentry, FAA has done a pretty good job. Unfortunately, the last go around, they were trying to get to a more streamlined and a more outcome-based system rather than a sort of an ex-ante system. And they kind of fumbled on that with a huge set of 800 and some odd pages. But they're back at it trying to. I think we're going to get there on launch and reentry. It's the problem of who's going to regulate this innovative space stuff. Who's going to regulate going to the moon? And it's not clear. And that's unfortunately going to take Congress to answer it. And we all know how difficult a time Congress is having in doing anything substantive these days.
Dean or Rick, any last comments before we wrap up?
Sure. Just real quick. Always remember, executive orders can be overturned in the next administration. So any progress that has been made without the law changes that Jim mentioned is at best temporary. The other thing here, and I do want to, I don't disagree with anything Rick said, but I do want to point out Artemis is 67 members now. If the Chinese land on the moon before we do, you have to wonder how many of those Artemis members might decide, you know what? They're the faster, better horse than the Americans are.
Rick, any last comments? I'll turn it over to Libby, if not.
No.
Okay, thank you all. This was excellent. I enjoyed it very much and appreciate your participation.
Wonderful. I will reiterate that, Margaret, and thank you all so much for sharing your expertise on this fascinating and important issue. And thank you, of course, to Margaret for moderating as well. If our audience is interested in learning more about all of our programming here at the Federalist Society, please visit our website at fedsoc.org. That is FEDSOC.org. Or feel free to send us your feedback. We always love to hear it at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you all so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.